Welcome to another edition of Sci-Fi on Screen. I'm your host, Jeff Palermo. And today we're going to be talking about 1979's Star Trek The Motion Picture on episode 11 of Sci-Fi on Screen. Let's get right to it. Let's get into the background a little bit of Star Trek The Motion Picture. You know, the success of Star Trek The Original Series in syndication was kind of an interesting thing that happened in the early 70s. A lot of people my age, 40s and 50s, we came to Star Trek really in syndication, and it was very successful as a syndicated television show. At some point in the 70s, Paramount tried to get a film off the ground, basically even before Star Wars, as early as 1975. They got some writers in the room, tried to find a good story, couldn't come up with one, and then they thought about rebooting Star Trek and calling it Star Trek Phase 2. Just another TV series, which I think Phase 2 eventually became Next Generation. Phase 2 was sort of in development, and then Close Encounters came out. Obviously, Star Wars had been out. Film production studios were getting their first taste that, you know, sci-fi cinema could be a lucrative market. And so they gave the go-ahead to Star Trek, as it was a already tested franchise and intellectual property. The shooting script for Star Trek The Motion Picture came out of the pilot of Star Trek Phase 2. I think it was called The God Machine. And that became, you know, reworked and dealt with, became the shooting script for Star Trek The Motion Picture. So briefly, you know, Roddenberry very much involved in the writing of the script. The film was directed by Robert Wise, who directed 1951's Day the Earth Stood Still, which I'll probably cover at some point. It's a classic. Directed the submarine film Run Silent, Run Deep. More recently, when this film was put out, The Andromeda Strain, the Michael Crichton film. Before I start talking about this film, I want to talk a little bit about Star Trek versus Star Wars, because, you know, this film is maligned, and, you know, in a lot of ways, rightly so. It's a very long, kind of undramatic film that doesn't really go anywhere. Star Trek from the get-go, while it had its action, you know, as a television show, right, while it's had its action oriented stories, was very much a TV show about ideas. And, you know, Roddenberry's incredibly optimistic and wonderful vision for the future was this polyglot mix of cultures coming together. You know, their main goal is to explore and to, you know, the prime directive being that we will not interfere. Something, you know, living in the United States in 2015, as I do right now, it seems like a fantasy, you know, that there would be a benign empiric power that would, you know, one of their directives would be, well, we will not interfere with cultures that are, you know, still developing. Like, it's kind of a joke nowadays, right? For Roddenberry, this was this is the core tenet of Trek. So many situations in Trek, Kirk and crew go out of their way to, you know, work nonviolent solutions to problems. They have this incredible technology. And what's great about the original series is so much of the show comes from Kirk's unwillingness to use the power of the Enterprise, the power of the Federation, to force solutions to problems that would be easily solved were he just to kind of, you know, kill some people or wipe out half a planet or browbeat people. And more, you know, what he's attempting to do is to solve problems using the quite liberal tenets of the Federation of non-involvement and, you know, convincing people that they don't want to take over indiscriminately. They actually do want peace, and at times putting himself and his ship through an incredible amount of danger and damage, you know, in order to withstand the initial aggression that comes from the culture that they're interacting with, in order that he can prove his point. You know, it's a very noble, and that Roddenberry being at the helm of the three original series seasons, which is where we are when this film comes out. It's all we've seen of Trek, other than the animated series, which came out a few years later. That philosophy is very much alive. It informs the entire show. You know, you do have action sequences, and there are phaser firings and battles that come, but it's mostly when the Federation's hand has been forced. Every once in a while, there are, you know, where they steal the cloaking device, right? And so that, you know, there are moments when they do what they need to do in terms of being a power in the galaxy to keep themselves safe. But overwhelmingly, the show plays upon these ideas that we would go out and seek peace at almost any cost. You know, so many times Kirk is willing to kind of, he doubles down and he's willing to sacrifice his ship rather than be violent. And it's a wonderful and very advanced idea. And I think it lives in the TV shows. And then you have Star Wars, right? The Star Wars universe is a very action-oriented universe. They're battling and fighting. And yes, the main idea is that they're fighting off the Galactic Empire, but it's very action-oriented and harebrained escapes. And, you know, it's much more action-oriented as an idea, you know. And I think what's happened is, I mean, sci-fi cinema really has sprung out for the most part, sci-fi cinema has really sprung out of the Star Wars tradition. Most sci-fi films are sci-fi slash action films. Every once in a while, you'll get a brooder like Under the Skin or, you know, Blade Runner or something where, you know, you're getting something else besides the action. But these days, 9 times out of 10, when you go to see a sci-fi film in the cinema, it's full of action. People lambaste the Star Trek film as being so incredibly slow and incredibly boring, and it is, let's face it. I mean, it's a very slow and boring film, and there's no getting around to that. The thing about Trek, which has been lost in the J.J. Abrams movies, unfortunately, and I like the Abrams movies as artifacts of their own, but Trek is after a different game than Star Wars. You know, Star Wars just wants to entertain you at all costs and dazzle you. Trek is after a philosophical game. It's after a moral game, and it wants to explore those concepts in a science fictional setting. And I think the way the motion picture sort of ended up was a result of Roddenberry trying to put those ideas up on screen, unsuccessfully, for sure, only to look to Kubrick's 2001 to see how they can be put up on the screen successfully. These days, science fiction has been very much dumbed down in film. It's become, you know, places where you can do a lot of flashy visuals and you can do a lot of action. And, you know, the genre itself has definitely come down a peg. It's more entertaining than it's ever been before. Let's put it that way. But in terms of, you know, science fiction being a way into sort of philosophical or thematic dramatizations, you know, it's gone. I mean, it's pretty much gone. And Trek has fallen into that trap as well. And although it's in the J.J. Abrams films, you know, it's still there. There's an Into Darkness. They were playing with some ideas. It's nowhere nearly unified as it was sort of in the original series. With that, I'm going to begin talking about Star Trek, the motion picture. When this film came in 79, you know, Trek fans were pretty rabid. They had banded together and gotten the first testing orbiter called Enterprise, and they renamed it Enterprise. Of course, it never went into space. It was only the test version that they dropped from airplanes. So there was some fan base. The conventions were starting. You know, the only other Star Trek media that had been released since the, you know, besides there were novelizations that were released, was the animated series. Anticipation was very high among fans. And so let's get into the film. So the first shot of the film is the V'ger cloud. We have this new Klingon theme by composer Jerry Goldsmith, who subsequently would have a longstanding relationship with Star Trek and their film and TV themes. Oh, another a note on film music. What's notable here is that the music introduction is music that will be later used in Star Trek The Next Generation as their main theme song. So, you know, one odd artifact of this film is that if you haven't seen this film and you're a Next Gen fan and the film starts, it's the Next Gen film music. It's very wild. So, just another odd beginning. I think they've come up with new music for the Trek films subsequently to this film. That integrates more of the original series themes, I think. It's very strange to see the Next Gen music playing and, you know, it's a original series film. And we see these three new K'Tinga class Klingon warships. And basically they were sort of upgrades from the old D7 class battlecruiser that we've seen in the TV show. And they look great and they're filmed really well. And we go into the Klingon bridge, and it's very sinister looking, you know, a little bit of smoke or fog and very dramatic lighting, but dimly lit. And then, you know, as fans, the first time we saw these new Klingons, they have these weird ridges on their heads. And Klingons in the old TV show were basically, you know, they looked like they were sort of the Chinese, as it were. The Klingons and the Romulans had a sort of Eastern look. They didn't have any bony ridges on their heads or anything. They just had sort of things done to their ears and their eyes to make them look a little exotic. So we see these cool ridges, which in Trek lore, which I won't get into now, there's a reason why we see the ridges, and it has to do with a plague that the Klingons had to battle, which changed their genetic structure in certain ways. But that retconning came later. Basically, they look cool. You know, the camera starts in front of the ships, and then the camera goes up and the ships pass underneath, the camera pivots, and we see the ends of the ships, and they're definitely models. You know, you can definitely get this tactile sense of the ships. So they were built models and not CGI. And as you're seeing them go towards the cloud, you're seeing them in context of this massive, massive structure. And then we move closer into the bridge of the lead Klingon ship, and basically the Klingons doing what the Klingons do best. They don't know what they're dealing with, so they open fire on the cloud, and their torpedoes have no effect. So they immediately take evasive action, but the cloud fires back. This odd weapon that it has, sort of the three ships get, looks like completely disintegrated. We find out later that they were actually digitally dismantled so they can be reproduced inside of V'ger's memory banks. But at this point, they are gone. So let me cut to what's called Comm Station Epsilon 9, some kind of communications relay station. And they intercept the Klingon distress call. And from their perspective, we see the three ships disintegrate via the cloud. And from them, we also get the data that the cloud is heading to Earth, and we've got the beginning stage set for our plot. Now we switch to Spock. We switch to Vulcan. Spock is undergoing the Kolinar ritual. He's, you know, this wonderful temple, and he's outside, and he's in this religious garb. And at some point, he senses the consciousness of the cloud, and it distracts him from his meditation. And so he sort of heads back towards the temple, and it's a pretty bad CGI shot. Not CGI, but it's just a bad special effect shot of the Vulcan temple. Does not look very real. You know, they're about to, you know, offer him this medallion, which symbolizes that he has undergone the Kolinar ritual, and he pushes his hand against it. And again, the cloud intervenes in his consciousness. So this high priestess touches his head and recognizes that this cloud has touched his human side through this, however it's communicating with him, that he cannot achieve Kolinar. She throws the thing on the ground. Vulcans are pretty harsh with each other, frankly. Basically, she's telling Spock that his answer lies elsewhere. And we cut away next, and now we're at Starfleet headquarters, and we see Kirk. Wise definitely gives us a sense of scope in Starfleet headquarters and later on the Enterprise. I mean, in a sense, with Wise shooting this film, the Enterprise has never looked bigger on the inside. You know, we really never get much of the Enterprise other than hallways and the bridge and sickbay, you know, and a lot of other shows. Wise opens up the Trek world a little bit. The layout looks a little bit like, it's a little dated, you know, it looks a little bit very much like 1970s science fiction set would look. And Kirk meets Commander Sonak, who's a Vulcan, who's the new science officer on the Enterprise. And we hear them talking, and this commander, or Captain Decker, I should say, is in charge of the Enterprise, and, you know, Kirk is sort of on his way to meet with an Admiral Nagura. We get a sense that he's been, you know, given some kind of mission. We're not sure what it is yet. Then we get a cut to space dock. It's not Star Wars quality at this point, you know, but it's pretty solid still. Holds up. They look the way they have looked in the movies since, and it's pretty solid, and Wise takes his time. And we see at space dock, we meet Scotty, and Kirk and Scotty are talking, and the transporters on the Enterprise are not working, and we get told that the Enterprise has been refit. And Scotty, of course, is bitching and moaning about, oh, we don't have time, this is broken, and Kirk tells him about the mission at V'ger. Of course, as always, right, the only starship in the system. We get this impression just watching Kirk that, you know, he grabbed onto this whole mission as a way to get the Enterprise back. You know, when they're in this little shuttle pod from space dock headed towards the Enterprise, he turns towards Scotty and he's like, they gave her back to me, Scotty. You know, so he's sort of, you know, passionately very much involved and wanted to get back into space. And the 5-year mission has supposedly ended, and Kirk's been in his desk for 2.5 years, and he's admiral now, and he's not happy about it. So now we get these really lengthy flyby. So now we get an incredibly lengthy flyby of Enterprise. And this one is for the fans. This is, I think, Wise just saying, this is for you guys, because it's really long. He takes his time. You know, they do 2 passes, almost 2 full passes by. And first you see it through the sort of skeleton of the space dock that it's part of. And, you know, the refrit encumbrance that's around it, you know, and you see every section, and it's great. And the second pass, we get a sense of Kirk as he lights up. Like, this is really, this is the love of Kirk's life. And this was touched on in some of the original series episodes as well, that this ship is Kirk's love of his life, pretty much. I don't know, like it or not, as a fan, this is the first sequence that you're getting an extended visual look at things, and very unhurried, you know. And at this point, it seems very much like a fan's film. Who knows how much Roddenberry has influenced this and how much 2001 has influenced it because of the slowness of things, but... So the shuttle lands. I was thinking when I saw this that the entry of the shuttle bay looks a little bit like a James Bond villain's lair, you know? It has a nice big scope to it, which, you know, Wise is giving you the interior of the Enterprise, and he's giving you these big bays, these big areas. You know, they gather in the wreck deck later on, and it's a big set, you know, and there are a lot of people, and I don't think you've ever gotten this sense of scope inside the Enterprise in any of the other past films. One thing that Wise does really well. Kirk enters the bridge, and the bridge is just a cacophony of, like, guys repairing things and talking about guys up in ceilings and wires are out. And, you know, as fans, we revisit Uhura, Sulu, and Chekhov, who are on the bridge, you know, getting her ready. We hear talk about these new warp engines that will refit. And the strange thing in this film, too, that they didn't do in other films, is there's a lot of announcements on the loudspeaker. And, again, it's more of like the Bond lair kind of thing, where it's like, you know, you just have this voice like, so-and-so report to Section 52, and, you know, so-and-so report to this or report to that. And it's like either the Death Star or Drax's lair and Drax's lair in the Moonraker. It's very weird. Trek doesn't really do that kind of stock sci-fi kind of thing, but Wise adopted it for this film only, and I think it was removed, and they got back to better things as this, after this film. I don't know. It's an interesting artifact to appreciate. We first meet our Captain Decker as he and Scotty are sort of, you know, dealing with the warp engines, and we see Decker knows a lot about engineering. So a bit of trivia: Captain Decker is the son of Commodore Decker, who we met in the Star Trek original series episode "The Doomsday Machine," and Decker had survived attack by the giant planet killer. He was on the USS Constellation. And at one point, Decker steals a shuttle and he attempts to attack the planet killer, and he's destroyed. And Kirk later on takes the Constellation and, you know, rams it down the throat of the planet killer and destroys it. But so a little bit of trivia there that Decker is, you know, has some Star Trek lineage. We get the first idea that, you know, Kirk doesn't really know the ship at all. Decker kind of is putting it to him. When he tells Decker that he's taking over, Decker's like, you know, he's kind of pissed off. And he tells Kirk pretty straight, you've wanted to get this ship back your whole life, and you finally have gotten it, you know, way to go. And so he's kind of angry that he's been demoted to commander just for this mission. And Kirk is basically, you know, he kind of stands his ground, as Shatner will do. And Shatner does great. You know, he's able to give Kirk life, you know, dramatic life, but he also has a wonderful command gravity that he can put on as well. And I rediscovered that recently watching the original series. I realized how we remember Shatner as this histrionic performer who's, you know, with his odd speech patterns, as they are, right? But a lot of Trek, he's very low-keyed. He plays Kirk very subdued, but underneath that is this incredible sense of command and power. And, you know, it's a really great quality, and he definitely brings that here. So now we, as a screenwriter, we need to make way for the entrance of Spock later, right? So we have Commander Sonak, who's the current Trek Vulcan science officer. He dies horribly in a transporter accident. They have the transporter malfunctioning, and it basically turns Sonak and some other crew member into, you know, piles of goo, which don't live long when they're pulled back towards Starfleet headquarters. So then we get the crew assembled on the wreck deck of the Enterprise, and Kirk basically makes the announcement of what they're doing, and he shows them the video of what happened to the Klingons, and that the cloud is 82 AUs in diameter, which is pretty astonishing, actually. And at that point, Epsilon 9 station comes into attack, and it's fed into the live video, and they are sort of dematerialized just like the Klingon ship was, and we watch it happen. So the stakes are a bit raised that nothing can stand in this thing's way, and it's headed to Earth. Next, we get Lieutenant Ilea, who enters the ship, who is what's called a Delton, which is before or since in Star Trek lore. As far as I'm aware, I don't think they ever really got into what the Deltons were. I think, you know, looking at this ship, looking at the actor that they chose to play Decker, you know, the, I guess these Deltans are sort of hyper-sexual beings, and like they can seduce people at the drop of a hat. So she says something like, you know, Captain, my oath of celibacy is on record. So I guess Deltans need to take this oath of celibacy in order to keep, you know, the male crewman of the Enterprise from, you know, attacking her. But it made me think that this was the early prototype, sort of Ilea Decker, very much Riker and Troy on Next Gen, right? Because they do better with Troy being a Beta Zed. So she's empathic and they desexualize her to a certain extent. I mean, she's definitely a very sensual character on Next Gen. But Riker's very much Commodore Decker. And of course, they have a past relationship, Riker and Troy. Made me think of, like, you know, why Phase 2 became Next Gen. They already had some of these ideas worked out of the composition of the crew. So then we have a bearded McCoy who gets beamed up, cranky as all hell. Kirk, I think, had told Nguru, like, I need McCoy. And so he had kind of no choice. Some little known clause in Starfleet reactivated him as ship's doctor. And I like Kirk here because Bones is all cranky and pissed off. And Kirk's like, damn it, Bones, I need you. And it's no bravura, right? It's Kirk. He's just like, I need you, man. And it's this wonderful, well thought out character triangle of Kirk, Spock, and McCoy, and what McCoy and Spock are to Kirk. The sort of the, you know, they're the, his intellect and his morals, you know, in a sense. Because McCoy is always this moral human piece of him, and Spock being the, you know, the intelligence, logical side. It's just such a great setup in terms of his two main advisors being these two characters. And it's great to just see Kirk very vulnerable. Like, I need you, man. I really need you. And Bones kind of drops his crap when Kirk does that. So it's nice. As a, you know, as fans of the series and we know these characters, it's good. It's good. Now we have the launch of the Enterprise. It takes a long time. It's a very slow and very long sequence of the Enterprise pulling out of the space dock, and it's majestic, yes, but this is the beginning of Wise spending, well, I'll put it this way. It's not that he's spending too much time on the awe and wonder of what they're seeing. Is what's going to start to, what starts to become evident here is that there's not a counterpoint to it. There's no real dramatic stakes in this film, you know, between the characters. You know, obviously the story is somewhat dramatic in itself, but there is no real human drama in this film until like the last 15 minutes. It takes so long for the drama to really gel, and it's because it's paced so poorly and how it's shot. You know, there's really, and it makes me think that to try to expand a TV pilot to a two-hour film, number one, you know, they had to expand it in time, which made the shot so incredibly long. And number two, the stakes for cinema have to be higher than the stakes for a TV show. They just do. You know, you can do like well-made plays in space and get away with it in a TV show. And that's kind of what you want. For filmic experience, especially science fiction, Star Trek, it's got to be a little grander and a little deeper and a little more has to be at stake. And yes, the fate of the Earth is at stake, but you're not getting any character development here as you get in the later Trek films, which make them just better films. You know, you're getting the bare bones of their characters, but not much, as I'll continue to report as we go. Bones comes to the bridge. You know, there's this initial conflict in that Kirk wants to get to warp speed, and he's told by Decker and Scotty that the engines aren't ready. It's nice. Bones is behind him. He's like, Jim, you're pushing. Your people know their jobs, you know, and he's already there because, and that's why Kirk needs him there. He wants that advice from Bones. But Kirk brushes them all aside, and we see the new warp special effect, which is a really cool set of circle of lights, and the streaks goes into warp. And then there's this neat wormhole. So there's a whole wormhole sequence where, you know, the imbalance of the engines created a wormhole and it pulled in an asteroid. So they're stuck in this wormhole, and there's an asteroid also in the wormhole that's heading right for the Enterprise, and they don't have any shields up because of the imbalance. And everything is done in real slow motion. You know, everything's slowed down. It's, I guess, the wormhole effect. And it takes too long, and it's very goofy when they're arming torpedoes or pushing buttons. Like, you see the whole thing. Just takes forever. It's a very weird, it's a cool, uncanny sequence that if they had shot it and edited it better, it would have been nice, but it's drawn out and it's weird and it takes too long. And the only drama in it really is that Kirk orders phasers to fire on the asteroid. Decker belays the order, chooses photon torpedoes instead. Once they get out of the wormhole, you know, Kirk brings Decker and McCoy into sort of this ready room, and he's like, why'd you countermand my orders? And Kirk's really pissed off, and he's really ready to give it to Decker. And Decker says, look, you know, when the engines went into imbalance, The new phasers are strengthened by being channeled through the warp core itself, and when the core was imbalanced, the phasers went offline. Kirk realizes that he saved the ship, and he admits it, which is a great Kirk character, that he admits it to Decker. He's like, you acted properly, of course, and you saved the ship. And Decker's like, I'm aware of that, sir, and they go back and forth. And it's good. It's a little good. It's a good conflict, but there's not enough of Kirk's arc and what he wants. And Decker, there is no character. Decker's just there to be used at the end of the film, as we'll get to. There's absolutely no arc, and there's kind of a nothing character there. And it's too bad, because the actor playing Decker, Stephen Collins, is very good. So Decker leaves, and then we have this scene between McCoy and Kirk. And McCoy really gives it to Jim, like his obsession. It's not Decker that's competing. It's he's that's competing. And, you know, he's there really as friends will psychologize with each other. Like, he's doing it for Kirk. It's for his benefit. And they have a really solid friendship. Kirk doesn't want to hear it, so it's not really an easy parting, you know, and they have this little tiff. And it's good, you know. So then we have the arrival of Spock. There's this shuttle, which you see on the side called the Serac, which, you know, is, I think, the name of one of the founders of the current Vulcan civilization. It's a good moment for an entrance because it's just come after their first little dramatic moment. We're not to the cloud yet. Spock basically has sensed the cloud and he wants to get there because he senses this level of intelligence, this perfect part, this perfect brain that he senses is something that he really wants because at this point, you know, he wants to purge himself of all emotion and all human feeling. And again, it's undercooked. I mean, Spock has a nice arc here, but it's very much underdone. And it's only by really being very attentive to what's going on in the film do you realize that Spock's arc now is that Spock is seeking to eradicate his human self. And he wants to go as far as he can to finally and completely get rid of this piece of himself that Spock himself probably believes is holding him back from achieving this like next level of development. And in a sense, Spock's arc is sort of like V'ger's arc. It's very similar. They don't have, at the end of the movie, they don't have, Spock is the explainer for V'ger, but it's not, there's not enough where you're getting it. It's, you know, you put the dots together eventually, but it doesn't have thematic resonance in the film because it's not dramatized enough. Spock is very cold. I haven't seen him in a long time. And so because of the Kulinar, where he is in his emotional development, he's completely reactionless. You know, like he doesn't smile or flinch. He just comes aboard, takes his, so it's kind of a deflated moment there, which we've seen with Spock, of course, in the past. The joy of the rest of the cast reacting to him sort of, it gets to you as a Star Trek viewer. Like, they're all excited to see him, and there's this notion of, like, we're getting the band back together again, and it's nice. It's nice. And there's a quick music cue here. I think it's the only one from the original series, the old Alexander Courage theme is quickly in and out here. Spock arrives. He immediately gets to work. He knows what's wrong with the engines because Spock is extremely smart. He's an amazing scientist, so he helps balance the engines with the equations, and they're off towards the cloud. On the way there, Spock, McCoy, and Kirk sit down. They want Spock to kind of tell him what's been going on. Of course, Spock's just, he's really not interested in the niceties of friendship, and he does tell them about what's happening with his connection with what they think is the entity. They don't know its name, obviously, right now. And he leaves. Bones is basically like, Jim, I don't know, you know, is he really fit for this mission? It looks like a very personal thing for him. And Kirk just exclaims, I need him, Bones. I need him. You know, the way he says it to Bones, I need you. That he needs his two friends, his two best friends and counselors on this mission. We're getting some nice Kirk moments here, but again, it's so undercooked. There's no real knitting together of the stories of any of these people in this film. They're all just, you know, on a ship waiting to fulfill their mission. So they finally encounter the cloud. They're scanned. They come to understand that there's an object at the cloud center. We hear this wonderful cloud sound effect, which sounds like a plucked piano string, you know, turned way down in the bass. It's very cool. The cloud, the way it's shot on the version I saw, every once in a while, the cloud special effects are very sharp and clear. They look amazing. And then there are times when it looks bad, when it looks like they just patched something in from, you know, the old TV show. So they're not very consistent. Spock still has this sort of connection with the alien. So what's happening there is that Spock is telling the Enterprise that the alien is confused because there's been no response from the Enterprise. The ship's fired upon by the cloud as the Klingon ships were, and we get a sense that the Enterprise is since it's, you know, fresher off the assembly line, that it's actually more powerful than the Klingon ships because the shield holds off the first blow, although Chekhov's arm gets fried. And they find out, finally, that the probe has been trying to communicate on this archaic frequency. It's been out of use for years. Spock figures it out, and they adjust their response. They reply in kind, and some nice tension here as the second weapon is released, heading towards the ship. And just before it hits, the code is transmitted, and the weapon dematerializes. At this point, you know, Decker is very much against going into the cloud, and he's kind of showing his rookie stripes. And you know, Kirk is like, "This is why we're here. You know, the stakes are these are the biggest stakes you could possibly have in what we're doing here. We have to go in." And we see that Kirk being in command actually makes a lot of sense, and Decker's kind of too new at space exploration to kind of understand the game in this way. So now we get this very long set of sequences where they're traveling towards the center of the cloud. They really try for a sense of grandeur here. They try to show you how dwarfed the Enterprise is by this incredible cloud. I mean, it's 82 AU, and an astronomical unit, an AU, is the distance between the Earth and the Sun. You know, I don't think the Enterprise is going 82 AU in the space of they show you in these series of shots, so that's a little bizarre. What I do like is with they're trying to, you know, and I think sitting in the theater would be a different story. They're trying to get, Roddenberry's trying to get into the wonder and awe of, and strangeness of exploring the universe, or exploring the galaxy, I should say. I like that. I wish, you know, that it were done with a little more flair. Or the effects are very dated for the most part. A lot of the things we see in Cloud, you know, 1979. It's very similar to the Stargate sequence in 2001. Strangely enough, those effects seem somewhat less dated at times than these do at this point. There are times when we see a tiny Enterprise flying past these gargantuan shapes and spheres and tunnels, and we get a sense of the scope of the thing. And it's really cool, you know, and you realize how huge this cloud is, you know, 82 AU or not, and what the Enterprise is sort of up against in terms of scale and awe. And that's cool. But it's just, it's too long, I think, now, because I'm not marveling at every, you know, if these were cutting edge effects and I was just in awe of pure visuals on the screen, might be a different story. And I think that's what they were going for. So then we have our next sequence where there's a pillar of plasma that appears on the deck. And it scans the ship, and there's some drama because Spock tries to destroy the computer. The pillar sort of shocks him with some kind of energy. Spock is sort of knocked across the room. Eventually finds this Lieutenant Ilia, and Ilia vanishes along with the pillar. And they assume that she's dead. Decker sort of chides Kirk about, you know, the stakes being too high. And at this point, the cloud takes control of the Enterprise, and it's now being slotted further through this massive cloud. And again, we're more gargantuan scale, and every once in a while is a cool shot, but it's taken forever at this point. Ilia is then returned as a probe construct that was created by V'ger, and we find out V'ger is this consciousness, and Ilia is the probe that is there on the ship to explore. And we hear that the actual Ilia is dead, and V'ger patterned this sort of probe on her, but she is gone. Little plot information, you know, V'ger's heading towards Earth to reunite with something it calls its creator. There are times when Ilia seems to recognize Decker for some brief moments. And basically, Kirk charges Decker to be Ilia's guide because they're theorizing that there are certain memory patterns that V'ger may have copied a little too well, that there may be more of Ilia in that probe than even V'ger realizes. And so Kirk wants to get Decker to try to bring those things out since, you know, they used to have this past love relationship. So first Decker attempts to bring it to the wreck deck and play some games with it. It pretty much fails. And then we get this bit of upping of the stakes. And as they're leaving the game room, she says, you know, once I've completed my mission, all the carbon-based units infesting Enterprise will share the fate of the Klingon ships. And, you know, Station Epsilon 9 as well. They'll just be destroyed and patterned into V'ger's memory banks. A little by little, we're seeing every once in a while Ilia's sort of memory of Decker's coming through. It doesn't really work well. It doesn't really play on the screen for whatever reason. So now we cut to Spock by himself in another area of the ship, and he nerve pinches one of the guards and steals what they call a thruster suit. And this is his moment, pretty much why he came on the ship. He wants to make direct contact with V'ger. And he's recording this sort of log in case he dies, but the suit gets back. Sort of this, there's this V'ger's orifice, as even Spock calls it, kind of funny, briefly opening and closing, sort of as if it was breathing. Sort of Spock times the thruster suit and he shoots through, and we get some like 2001 helmet effects on Spock as he's heading through the next level of the cloud. And then he finds some other Ilia probe, the kind of the way they light it makes it look like a Star Child. And we get a sense that this is sort of a more central version of V'ger, and he tries to mind meld with it, but he kind of blows him away. Like, he's completely overmatched. And then we cut back to the Enterprise, and Kirk is in a thruster suit in front of the ship, which makes no sense. And Spock comes tumbling back out, and Kirk catches him. And there's absolutely no reason the captain would be out in a thruster suit. You know, and he doesn't, we don't know if he's told anyone he was going out there or he did it on it. Roddenberry just wants the scene of Kirk catching Spock. And that's how he sets it up. It doesn't make any sense. So now we cut to sick bay, and Spock wakes up and he's laughing, which is always great. Trek universe, see Spock laugh. We get some more plot, some exposition, and that V'ger is actually a living computer that has become self-aware. It's this great moment where he grabs Kirk's arm and he says, Jim, this feeling I have right now, the simple human feeling is completely beyond V'ger's comprehension. It cannot understand. He sensed the questions that V'ger is asking itself. Is this all I am? Is there nothing more? And again, you know, it's just very much Spock's show here because this is Spock's journey, you know, that he's trying to go another level in his development by purging his human emotions. And part of being on this mission makes him realize that his human emotions and his human side is an asset, and it allows him to make leaps of deduction or leaps of faith or leaps of the imagination that his logical side cannot. And I think it's, in a sense, Spock's character arc in all of the Trek shows and movies. Because after this, you know, Spock gets away from, he's not so much anti-human, and he kind of really takes the human part of himself in. But the sucky thing is you don't really see that. You do a little bit, but it's the way this movie is filmed, you really don't get that sense that Spock really comprehends that for himself. I don't know, you sort of do, but you sort of don't. So now we're entering like the end of the film. The cloud that V'ger has traveled in has completely dissipated. And V'ger and the Enterprise are approaching Earth orbit, and it's transmitting a signal, and it's peculiar. It's a radio signal, and in this era of like subspace communications and high-tech technology, that it's an old-style radio signal. And because there's no response, V'ger decides that, you know, the carbon-based units infesting Earth are going to be destroyed. So in one fell swoop, it deactivates Earth's planetary defenses, and then it positions these probes in these sort of very specific locations in orbit that once analyzed, they realized that from those locations, using its technology, can eradicate pretty much all life on Earth. So Spock theorizes at that point that dealing with a childlike intelligence, even though it is a, you know, the knowledge it amassed is almost godlike, it's still kind of like a child emotionally. It doesn't really understand, you know, and the quote from Spock is, it knows only that it needs, but like so many of us, it does not know what. Which I thought was a great quote. Now, finally, in this third act, we're getting more of like Bones' lines. He's funny. Spock's lines are very prescient. There's real drama. As things are closing in now, you know, after 2+ hours of very underwritten and overlong sequences, the film starts to gel here. They're bouncing off of each other as characters. There's real drama. There's an immediate problem to solve. And all of a sudden, the film sort of wakes up. It's too late, I think. But finally, you know, you're getting something that's seemingly dramatically in the moment at stake. Kirk now plays this gambit, and he tells V'ger that the carbon-based units will divulge the information of why the creator hasn't responded, but only if these items are removed from Earth orbit. And it's kind of cool. This is classic old school Kirk's gambits on the original series. V'ger learns quickly and says, I will take those things out of orbit, but you've got to give me the information first. And then Kirk counters and buys himself some time by saying, well, we have to do it directly to V'ger and can't give it through the probe. So some nice, you know, some nice chess moves back and forth. Decker, Kirk, Spock, and McCoy go with V'ger's probe, and V'ger creates this sort of atmosphere around the ship and this weird little polygonal landscape that leads up to this little area where V'ger is. So now we get the group walking on the Enterprise deck, and they walk onto these weird pylons that were provided by V'ger, and they inexplicably have changed uniforms, which is, I don't know, it's either bad continuity or in their like weird away tunics. And the away tunics are like a little rougher looking, you know. They're brown. I don't know. It's weird. It's goofy. So they get to V'ger, and it's a really good reveal that V'ger is the Voyager 6 probe. Of course, there were only two, you know, as far as we know right now, there's only Voyager 1 and 2. So in Star Trek lore, I guess there were more. We get this great backstory that Voyager 6 was lost in, quote, what they used to call a black hole, whatever that means. One of the visuals that Spock sees early on, or they all see, is this machine planet that's represented in when Spock gets sort of the inner sanctum. He sees all these representations of planets and all the places that V'ger's been, all the civilizations it's discovered. It looks like the home planet was this machine planet. The Voyager 6 probe falls into this machine planet. They take it in as one of their own. They basically, its programming is to just basically learn all that is learnable and report back to the creator. So it gives it a lot more technology to achieve that. Doing its mission, it amassed so much knowledge for so long that it achieves self-consciousness. And at this point, once, you know, it's learned everything and it's reached sort of the limits of its development and now wants to return back to its creator to find out, you know, to divulge the information, basically, is what we're given. It's a great idea, you know, very cool idea, very Star Trek. What Kirk finds out very quickly is that the signal that's not being answered, so the old signal that's being transmitted is the old signal by the probe signaling to have its data downloaded, basically. And, you know, no one on Earth remembers any of this stuff. And, you know, because it's not remembered, it could possibly be the end of, you know, the species. But of course, Kirk and company intuit all this, and they figure it out, and in the memory banks of the Enterprise is the correct code to transmit to V'ger. As they're transmitting the code, V'ger sort of short-circuits itself on purpose because it wants to join with the creator, and we don't really understand what that is. We get from Spock, who knows it the best, is like, you know, it's gone as far as it can go. It's learned all that is possible. You know, it needs the creator's humanity in order to sort of evolve as an intelligence, as a being. And of course, you know, they're asking, how's it going to join with a human being? And Decker all of a sudden lights up. We've been primed. Part of the movie is trying to tell us visually that, you know, Decker's falling back in love with Ilea and she still loves Decker. And as a pretext for what happens now, you know, is that Decker really wants to reunite with Ilea. Decker runs up and he's like, I want to do this. I want to do this. And Kirk tries to stop him and Ilea sort of, you know, pushes him aside. And then he has this line, is like, the way you wanted the Enterprise, Jim, I want this. At this point, we realize that Decker's completely an underwritten character. We don't know that he wants this. We don't know that he wants anything, frankly. We have no idea who Decker is as a character, except that he seems to be a pretty competent Starfleet officer. We know nothing about what he wants and what he doesn't want. So his desire to jump into this and abandon Starfleet and the universe to be part of this new being makes no sense at all. None. It's a nice, clean way for the movie to end without having to take, you know, any of the Star Trek personnel and give V'ger what it wants. But it's too neat and too clean, and there's no stakes at all. Some neat light effects, although there's some weird... when Decker starts to dematerialize, it's like there's a wind machine blowing his hair up. It looks like a bad Air Supply video, if you will. They join each other and they dematerialize together and, you know, there's this light effect and a new life form is born. And there's some mild, mild moments where, you know, Spock, McCoy, and Kirk have to run away because it's starting to eat up, you know, the surrounding structure and they have to get back on the Enterprise. And there's a little light flare and it vanishes. And the final line, obviously, Kirk is now back in command of the Enterprise and they ask him for a course and he's like, out there. That away, you know, which is a very Kirk thing, which is nice. And the film ends. As a first foray for Star Trek on cinema screen, I appreciate what Roddenberry and company were trying to do. You know, they were trying to keep it very close to the Trek's roots. They were trying to err on the side of doing something that was more involved with the awe and wonder of the universe and less with laser guns and lightsabers and damsels in distress. And there's discussion in this film thematically about what it means to be human, what it means to evolve, and the nature of humanity, which is wonderful. It's completely under-dramatized, so it doesn't really come up in the film as a unifying force. I appreciated, and that's a problem, I guess, with the first Star Trek film. I appreciated it a lot. I appreciated Wise's, the way Wise shot it. I do appreciate at certain times the slowness of certain things, appreciate the grandeur that Wise is trying to create inside and outside the Enterprise. Ultimately, this film is whisper thin, and there's very little drama in most of the film. Very little human drama. You know, you're basically on board what's like a documentary of the solar system, as it were, for the 2 hours, you know. And you're revisiting old characters. Those old characters are settling back into their relationships with each other. But that's not drama. You know, that goes along with drama. It's not drama itself. No one really has anything at stake here. Spock briefly does. It's like the only character that has any kind of arc. Kirk's character is briefly shown, but there's no real arc for Kirk in this as well. You know, he's, what does he want? He wants the Enterprise. Well, he gets it in the beginning of the movie. What does it cost him? Nothing. Decker's taken away at the end of the movie. Spock's arc makes the most sense to me, that he really is learning about to appreciate his human side and his human self and what that affords him as a conscious being, that he has, you know, two avenues in to appreciating the world and, perceiving the world. And he's beginning to understand that that's incredibly valuable. And I like that. I like that arc. It's cool. You know, the rest of the Star Trek characters never have arcs anyway. They're there for window dressing. I mean, V'ger has a very big arc, right? The antagonist, as you were, of the film has a big arc, has an arc as well. It wants to evolve. You know, I appreciate lots of things. I won't ever really defend this film. I don't think it's as terrible as people make out. It is a very boring film. Like I said, I think if you're a Trek fan, or if you're really a diehard sci-fi fan, you'll make your own interest. You know, as you're watching the film, you'll bring your own stuff to it that will get you through it. I don't think it's a film that will play repeatedly on a lot of people's DVD players, frankly. And there you have it. So I'll probably be covering almost all of the Trek films coming up. Obviously, after this movie came out, you know, the Star Trek franchise really kicked off with The Next Generation, Deep Space Nine, Voyager, and Enterprise. And then you had all of the original series movies, then the Generations film, which pivots into the Next Gen movies, and all up until today with the J.J. Abrams reboot movies. So definitely we'll be eventually hitting all of those, although for the TV show, it's probably just select episodes here and there because, you know, I have a limited lifespan. And that ends this episode of Sci-Fi on Screen. I want to thank you all for listening. You can find us on iTunes. You can find us on any mobile device that you may own. If it has a sort of a podcast app, and you type in Sci-Fi on Screen, you will find us and you can subscribe that way. We're at scifionscreen.com as well. There's a Facebook page called Sci-Fi on Screen. Always willing to hear feedback and suggestions. If you want to email me directly, scifionscreen@gmail.com. So thanks very much for listening, and I'll see you next time.